everybody. Nice of you to tune in today. I'm Henrik, and this is Red Ice Radio. We cover a lot of different topics, pretty much anything that we find to be important and interesting. RedIceCreations.com is our website where you can hear, see, and read more. John W. Whitehead is a constitutional attorney of national prominence and as a president of the Rutherford Institute, an international civil liberties organization. Whitehead has been at the forefront of the fight for civil liberties in the United States. Whitehead gained international renown as a result of his role as a co-counsel in Paula Jones' sexual harassment lawsuit against President Bill Clinton. He's the author of numerous books on a variety of legal and social issues, as well as pamphlets and brochures providing legal information to the general public. Whitehead has also written numerous magazines and journal articles. In addition, he wrote and directed the documentary video series Grasping for the Wind, as well as its companion book with a focus on key cultural events of the 20th century. Today, he is with us to discuss his latest book, A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State. The book charts American transition from a society governed by the people to a police state governed by the strong arm of the law. America was once a society that valued individual liberty and privacy, but in recent years, it has turned into a culture that has quietly accepted surveillance, cameras, drones, police and drug-sniffing dogs in the children's schools, national databases that tracks finances and activities, sneak and peek searches of homes without knowledge or consent, and anti-terrorism laws that turned average Americans into suspects. All right, well, welcome, John. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio. Good to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time coming on with us today.
Hey, thanks for the interview.
You bet, you bet. Now, we have a lot of things to discuss. I want to definitely get into your book, A Government of Wolves, The Emerging American Police State, a little bit later. A lot of good stuff in that book, and you have some great articles on your websites as well. But maybe you can just tell us a little bit about the Rutherford Institute first, when you started this, and kind of just give us a little bit of your background so our audience can get a feel for where you're coming from, John.
Yeah, I founded the Rutherford Institute in 1982. I was a young lawyer. I worked with various civil liberties groups and kind of people that were coming to me for help. No one, you know, they were people wanting to exercise their rights. They were having trouble getting help. So in 1982, I founded the Rutherford Institute, raised money from donations to help people get in the courtroom to fight their cases, no matter what they believed. I'll defend anybody as long as it relates to their freedom of speech, their right to be free from interference from government authorities. And so that's basically been the history of the group. We've been in almost 31 years. We've been in existence and handled thousands of cases on virtually every issue related to the United States Constitution.
And you had one of the, high-profile cases was regarding, was it Paula Jones as well? You helped?
Yeah, that was a very high-profile case. Paula Jones was a lady who alleged that President Clinton had touched her inappropriately in a hotel room, and we handled her case, deposed many women who said the same thing, had a lot of evidence, and the President of the United States settled out of court for $1 million to avoid the make sure the case didn't go any further.
Interesting. I guess that speaks on its own, but
it does. Yeah, when you dodge a bullet like that, a big bullet, there's something there. Yeah. We had we did depositions on a lot of females who claimed the same thing. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll see if we can talk more about that later. Why don't we get into A Government of Wolves here a little bit and talk about why you wanted to write this? I mean, your obvious kind of stance and position on this is how America has changed in all of its history. Obviously, it's been an ongoing change, but it's really escalated, I think, a majority of people and thinkers who agree after 9/11 specifically. And there's been a militarization of the police. There's been bigger and bigger government, in America, despite the Constitution saying otherwise and everything. Just give us an outline a little bit of where you see things, how things have developed in America and when this became a big concern for you, John.
Well, it was a concern when I started writing on it in the 90s, but after 9/11, you're correct, things ramped up or moved forward very aggressively. Starting in the 1980s, the Defense Department, the American U.S. Defense Department, started handing out military equipment across the country to American police, assault vehicles, flak jackets, all kinds of equipment, helmets. So they looked very much like the military. And they're called SWAT teams now, a lot of them. And all the federal agencies, by the way, in the United States government have SWAT teams now, which I don't know how it is in Sweden, but they actually crash down doors here in the middle of the night. They shoot dogs. People get killed. And a lot of it's just for misdemeanors, like marijuana possession, those kind of things. After 9/11, it actually ramped up further. And since President Obama's been in power, the Department of Homeland Security is handing out millions and millions of dollars worth of assault vehicles, all this equipment to local police. And they're actually training local police, the federal government. In this country, the police were supposed to be local police, peace officers that were basically civilians. That's all changed now. James Madison, who helped write our Constitution, he's called the father of the Constitution, did not believe we should have a standing army, which was armies on our soil, which basically worked like armies, arrested people like armies. But what's happened, that is now a fact in America, so that's radically changed. And like I say, we're having these so-called SWAT team raids where doors go down in the middle of the night. Well, there was a case of a Marine in Arizona named Jose Guerrero, a decorated Marine. He had fought in Afghanistan. The police in Arizona were doing a marijuana sweep of the neighborhood, trying to find people who had marijuana in their home. They actually broke down his door. Being a Marine, he was alert. He grabbed his family and put them in a closet, stood at the end of his hallway with a hunting gun. That's the only thing he had was a shotgun. In came the police. They fired over 70 rounds. 50 rounds hit him, killing him. He was bleeding to death on his floor. They wouldn't let the medics take care of him, the police. The police claimed that he had fired at them. An investigation was done, and they found out that his safety had never come off his weapon. He had never fired a round. They just got $3.4 million, by the way, from the government for that raid, but it doesn't help Jose Guerrero, who was killed. So those are the kind of things we're seeing in America, and that's one reason I wrote my book, The Government of Wolves. I've seen this developing, and I'm telling people in Sweden and the French, the British that interview me, I'm afraid this is it's going global. I mean, I see the police in Great Britain, for example. They look very, very similar to the police here. Their black outfits. And black, by the way, is, I'm told by psychologists, is not a good color for a policeman to be wearing. It's the color of authority. Used to, in this country, the policeman wore brown or blue outfits, which are friendly colors.
Yeah.
That's no longer true.
Huh, interesting.
That's what's happening in America. I mean, the estimate is as high as 80,000 SWAT team raids a year in this country.
Which 80,000 a year?
That's what some people claim. Wow. I think the actual number we get from the police is 50,000, but I've actually had people in the Secret Service tell me it's much higher.
Wow. Well, what is driving this then? I mean, we can look at this from a couple of different angles, and we'll do so. We'll get into crime statistics and everything, and kind of analyze this a little bit further. But
America has the lowest, since the 80s, crime has dropped drastically in America.
Right, exactly.
If 2013 ends like we think it is, it's the lowest murder rate in a century in America. So the crime rate's not driving it. As I show in my book, I have a chapter called The Psychology of Compliance. Studies show that when policemen put on military outfits, or anybody does, they act like the military. And I'm told by police that they're in the academies here, they're being trained very much like the military now to view citizens as enemy combatants. That's why you're seeing a lot of unarmed citizens getting shot in America now. There was a couple months ago, two policemen in Times Square in New York on Saturday night, which is the busiest time. I've been in Times Square. You may have as well. It's packed on Saturday night. They saw a guy dodging in and out of traffic. They fired into a crowd, shot two women. Come to find out the guy had no weapons. They shot two women. So we're seeing that kind of overreaction, but a lot of it goes to training. But I think more so it goes to what they're wearing, how they're trained. They all have military titles now, by the way, in this country. I don't know how it is in Sweden, but it's colonel, captain. So they're very much like the military in America.
How did this happen, and when did this change shift begin, John?
The initial shift began in the 1980s. Like I said, the Defense Department began handing out equipment. I think a lot of it was driven by corporate benefactors who make a lot of money from that, assault vehicles. They have vehicles now called MRAP. We have the police departments in America that have 20,000 people, the small towns, 50 policemen on a police force or less, and they have MRAPs, which are these things with turrets on the top, which, you know, if you go back 20 years ago, you never saw any of that. So it isn't that we're being invaded by terrorists. Like I say, no one believes that. There are terrorist attacks occasionally, but the crime rate's down, the murder rate's down. So, but like I show in my book, there is a psychology that works in people. In fact, they've actually done studies, as I show in my book. If you put for example, if you put a banana in somebody's hand, a banana, they look at it. If you put a gun in their hands, they've actually done studies. People, their hands clench for some reason. But by having a violent weapon in your hand, it changes your psychology.
Interesting. Now, what would you say then to those people who would argue that, crime has gone down because of these measures? What would you say to that?
No, the crime was dropping before any of these measures were put into effect. None of that's been proven. That doesn't account for it. That's why people are baffled. So that's why I did the book and studied it and saw that basically, America is a corporate state. It's heavily funded by corporations. Everything is driven by money. There's 25 lobbyists per congressman in America. I know people have trouble seeing their congressman because of the lobbyists in their office. So it's there's a lot going on here behind the scenes that we don't understand. But what we see visibly is the army of police like they're the military. And if I talk to people who work in some of the police academies, they tell this is how people are being trained in America. And so I've offered, by the way, to some of the American police academies to come in and teach some of our Constitution. We have a provision in our Constitution called the Fourth Amendment. It says that police can't touch you in any way, invade your home, unless they have what's called probable cause, that is, evidence that you're actually doing something illegal. They don't do that these days. I mean, even the Supreme Court in this country 2 years ago upheld that if a SWAT team arrives at an American citizen's home in the middle of the night and they don't have a warrant or any legal authority to go in, they can actually go through the door if they think you're doing something illegal. One judge, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, dissented in that case. She filed a dissent and said, this is wrong. It's going to destroy our Fourth Amendment. And she's absolutely correct.
Yep. Now, let's go back to the terrorist kind of argument again, because this seems to be one that is recurrent, and this is like for those who are arguing all of this, say that this is to protect us. There's a lot of dangerous people out there, and this is the only way to kind of to deal with it. But when you look at terrorism, and again, I mean, I would say alleged terrorism, because a lot of the operations that has been run have been more or less sting operations. Some of them have been led in unison with the FBI, and there's endless amounts of research done on this. But is that the card that usually is played, John, the terrorist card, and that's why the reason is for the militarization of the police?
Yeah, that's part of it. Here again, I do all the research on this. That's part of it. But they're just, again, how the police in America, and when I say police, I'm not just talking about what we call a local cop in Charlottesville, Virginia. All the federal agencies, the IRS, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Fisheries, the Department of Education have armed SWAT teams now. They work in conjunction with local policemen. So what's happened is, and as I show in the book, there's been a shift in how government authorities view the people here. And that's the most dangerous thing I'm seeing. So that really accounts for a lot of it. As far as terrorist attacks, I mean, we know the facts. There haven't been many in America. So occasionally, but shooting someone in their driveway in Peoria, Illinois has nothing to do with terrorism. I had a fellow who contacted me today, by the way. He said that he had read my stuff and he wasn't sure, my articles. And he said, what happened was one of my neighbors was killed the other night. I said, what did he do? He said he came home around midnight. He got out of his car. He had his hunting rifle in the back of his truck. A lot of people carry hunting rifles in their cars here. And he said his dog jumped out, ran down into the driveway barking really badly. Two policemen had called up to see had pulled up to see who it was. They shot the dog, the two policemen. This guy didn't know who they were. He grabbed his shotgun and turned, and they shot the guy in the driveway.
Wow.
And he was just, he didn't know who they were. They shot his dog. But that's routine now. That's an epidemic in America, and I've written on that, is the shooting of unarmed citizens. If you go back to as early as, the 1950s, early 60s, if an unarmed citizen got shot in America, huge investigation. Why could it, how could this happen?
Yeah.
Now it happens routinely in America, and no investigation.
What have you found when you try to get to the source of this again, and the change of it, if it's if we can pin it down to, I guess, is it an, you know, a conscious agenda behind people who are trying to change the outlook of you know, the government versus the American people, or how do we explain this?
I think it's more of a mindset that's coming out of the government. Again, we go back to the what I'm saying. We live in a corporate state here. It's driven by, a lot by money. Private enterprises, I don't think corporations are evil or anything like that, but they're there to make money. They lobby somebody to buy their vehicles, their assault vehicles, their rifles, their flak jackets, their helmets, all their flashbang grenades, which they throw in the house in the middle of the night to disorient people. They make a lot of money from that. Once it gets in the hands of a police unit, they put it on. They look like the military. They're in black outfits. If you've seen the movie Star Wars.
Sure have. Oh, yeah.
What color did Darth Vader wear?
All black.
There you go.
Yeah.
So it's that ominous thing. And just how police, I mean, again, I've been doing this for 40 years. I've seen the shift in how police approach citizens. Even in my small town here, I live in a small town of less than 50,000. What's amazing, and I've been involved in some instances where police walk up to just someone who might be arguing with somebody. It's their authoritarian nature now. Originally, police in this country didn't even wear uniforms. They wore civilian clothes. They were part of the people. To give you an example, when I was a young boy, on a Halloween night, I threw eggs at a car coming down a hill, just goofing around. The police chief actually caught me doing it. This shows you how things have changed. And he put me in the car, and I remember I was a teenager, and he says, I said, where are you taking me? He says, well, I'm not taking you to jail. I'm taking you to a worse place. And I said, where's that? He goes,
your parents.
I'm taking you home to see your dad.
Yeah, that's right.
He put me at home. My dad took me down to the basement. Thank my butt. I never did that again. They don't do that today. The things that I detail in the book, kids in public schools here and state-owned schools now, six-year-olds are being arrested for food fights. If you look at my book, I have a picture of some kids sitting in the courtroom. They got in a food fight. They have stripes on. They arrested them and took them to jail. When I was a kid, you're throwing food at another kid in the lunchroom. That's a crime now in America. We have a case that we're actually trying now, a little 10-year-old boy who went up to his teacher's desk to get a pencil. Walking back, another kid pretended to shoot him with a gun silently. Our kid took the pencil and made it into a bow and arrow, just imaginary bow and arrow, and shot an arrow at him. He was thrown out of school for that, and listen to this, in violation of a weapons policy the school had for shooting an imaginary arrow. He now has a weapons charge on his record. We're fighting that in court, we're probably, and trying to get that off his record. But for making an imaginary bow and arrow with a pencil,
wow,
he has a weapons charge. So that's how things have changed. And I'm afraid, you know, like in schools, we're seeing it in the schools, how kids are kind of being taught that they have to cower before authority. But the people who started this, that wrote our Constitution, didn't believe any of that. You know, that's why we have a First Amendment that says you have a right to petition the government, you have a right to assemble, you have a right to speak out against the government. We have cases now where people do Facebook posts, they get arrested just for criticizing the government.
Yeah, yeah. It's unbelievable how quickly that has changed as well.
The police are reading Facebook posts routinely.
How do they have time for this anyway? It's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? To sit there.
They're overstaffed. That's one thing I'm in by police as well.
Yeah.
Like in small towns now of 30,000 people, you have a staff of 200 policemen. who have nothing to do most of the time. What do? I mean, in some of these towns, I've been told there's almost a zero crime rate. Well, what do you do with 150 police in a town with zero crime rate?
Exactly. Yeah. What is the deal there anyway? Because if we really think about that, John, I mean, the concept there is that a police force would never want to truly have an interest in eradicating all crime. If they actually did, right, there would be no reason for that. They couldn't expand any further. So how do they maintain and justify their existence now when the crime rates actually are going down?
Doing an occasional SWAT team raid where they make a mistake. They don't have a proper warrant under our Fourth Amendment. Supposedly on the Fourth Amendment, if you have evidence somebody's doing something criminal, you have to go before a judge and argue your case that, well, I need to go on this guy's home. They don't do that anymore. Over-criminalization is a big issue in this country. People in this country now are fined and some arrested for having a chicken in their backyard, for growing vegetable gardens. In one California town now, it's illegal to smoke in your own home in America.
Yeah, that's
right. I just put an article on that called The End of Private Property. If you can't do what you want to do in your home, love who you want to, have sex with who you want to, smoke what you want to in your own home, grow a vegetable garden, have a chicken in your backyard to get eggs, what kind of country do you live in? Do people get arrested for that? I mean, we get involved in those cases. We were in a case a year ago where a fellow had a small group of religious people in his home to pray. Well, Phoenix, Arizona has a law against that. He spent 60 days in jail for defying and meeting in his home to pray. In America, a whole coterie of police came into this guy's home, like 10 cops in black outfits, searched his home. This is a guy who just wanted to pray, doesn't have a gun, nothing like that. So that's what we're seeing in this. It's got a lot of people frightened. I mean, and there's reason and concern.
Now, as you said, the time of the friendly neighborhood cop, that's pretty much gone in this state. So if you would describe to people, let's say that they haven't seen the dystopian movies, etc., they don't know kind of the idea of what the police state really looks like. I mean, you argue we're there already, and I wouldn't argue with that, but describe a little bit to us a full-on police state. How would you describe that to someone who's unfamiliar with that concept?
Well, people have to study history. Before I wrote this book, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't overextending my ideas and my research. So I went back and looked at Nazi Germany, because I hear people always talking about Nazi Germany and all the things. And I was surprised to find out that Adolf Hitler was a very popular fellow, a very good politician. He read polls. He presented his case well. Most of the people agreed with him. As early as 1933, there were articles running in newspapers across Germany about the concentration camp. And no one really cared, because guess who they were sending to the camp? Homeless people, gay people, eventually the Jews. And people kept saying, well, those are the bad folks we hear from the government, you know. And 3 or 4 years later, those same people were in the camp. So it was very friendly in Germany. Germany was the most cultured country in the world at the time. And, you know, people remember a lot of the great filmmakers came out of Germany. I mean, Albert Hitchcock studied in Germany.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a culture center. I mean, it was a far ahead of its time. And Hitler worked there. So it was a police state. It was a friendly police state to most of the people there, and they agreed with it. Even the religious group. There are pictures of churches with swastikas over the door and people going to church. So you can live in a police state and not know it if you're not alert. I mean, it's like the saying, the one-eyed man in the land of the blind, he's not a king, he's insane. So if you see these things and you go, hey, this is it, people go, oh, you're nuts. It'll never happen here. But, you know, there are a number of people since the 80s have been writing on this, written some really good books saying we're worried this is coming. But if you look at the science fiction literature, I mean, Orwell was right. He saw it coming in 1984. Aldous Huxley saw it coming. Philip K. Dick, and I hope your people read Philip K. Dick.
Oh yeah, yeah, great
he's
stuff.
He's coming. Yeah. Yeah. You've seen the movie Minority Report.
Yeah.
With Tom Cruise, all the technology in that film is already available for use by government agents in this country. The movie is set in 2054. We're 40 years ahead of the curve, so technology is moving fast. Another thing that's happening in this country is drones. Drones start flying legally over America in 2015. And I've written a lot on that. We might want to go into that in detail. But drones equipped with anti-personnel devices like rubber bullets, sound cannons, lasers, tasers, facial recognition software. I mean, what do you do if you're out on a street corner in America picketing against the government legitimately and you see a fleet of drones coming?
Yeah.
Well, I've asked some dissenters. They say, we'll run.
Yeah.
It's only going to get worse, the technology. But like I say, a lot of the science fiction writers saw it coming early on. Whether they were insane or not, I don't know. But now the people thought in the days, come on, that'll never happen. But, you know, remember Huxley said you could not go anywhere without being listened to or watched. Well, we know that's true now. The National Security Agency in this country, this interview we're doing is being downloaded. Anything electronic. The phones in America now are sound devices that can be turned on. The FBI says they can turn them on from a distance. Your laptop becomes a camera without you knowing it. So everything. I mean, I know people who won't even do text messages anymore in America. They're afraid they're being read.
Yeah.
But we live in a so-called democratic free society. If you live in a democratic free society, should you be worried? The government's listening to what you're doing and can use that against you. The thing is, I detail in my book, Martin Luther King, the great activist and my hero, by the way. The FBI collected 17,000 pages of information to use against him, to discredit the man. Why? Because he was leading a revolution for equality, a nonviolent revolution. So that shows you the mentality.
Why is the government so afraid of its people, do you think?
Well, it depends. I think that, you know, the word government means to govern or control, and that's essentially what I mean. People in power want to keep power. That's a natural instinct. People who wrote the Constitution said that. They said, you know, Thomas Jefferson, by the way, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, said you got to watch government officials continually. People misabuse power. There's all kinds of quotes from the so-called founding fathers saying that. That's why you need limited government. But we really don't have limited government anymore in this country, especially with a police state emerging. You just don't have that anymore. People in this country have not been very active politically either. So, I mean, even local city governments, people don't show up to meetings in this country anymore. So there's very little what I would call true political participation anymore. So. What we once had in this country is gone, in my opinion.
How can they get it back?
Education is the first step, I would say. Education precedes action. The second thing is the average American watches 160 hours of television a month in this country.
Yeah.
I'm telling Americans, take about one-third of that time and get active politically. It doesn't take an army. Martin Luther King was one guy, and he started an incredible movement. So you can change, but you have to get educated. That's why I wrote my book. That's why I write my articles, hoping people will listen. And some people are listening. But again, when you see things like this, I go back to that quote. People look at you and go, "Oh, you're a little nuts," you know, the one-eyed man kind of thing. But when you do the research, I mean, it's just obvious what's happening.
Yeah, indeed.
If you're not doing the research and you're watching a reality show in America, you don't see it. So James Madison, who was the founder of our Constitution, supposedly, he said, "Take alarm at the first experiment with liberty." Well, he was alarmist himself. And as I say to people in this country, the first experiment is gone. So it's important. And again, it's going global because I don't know if people in Sweden understand this, but the National Security Agency has basis.
We have our fair share, just to enlighten some people who don't know that and understand. We've actually one of the spearheading nations. We had something called the FRA. That's the the radio surveillance team, if you will, in Sweden, for the lack of a better translation, was actually one of the law that went into effect at the earliest stages. It was back in the late 90s, pretty much, and then it was ratified into effect in 2006, I believe, or 2007 possibly. So we've been along on that bandwagon as well, very, very early in the process. So it is worldwide, snooping and listening, and digital systems that are overseeing all the communications, emails, telephone, etc. It's out there,
Exactly. Well, the NSA has this program called Echelon, bases all over the world, Iceland, Great Britain, Australia, and they all hook up globally.
Yeah.
So you have what I'm calling in the book a global electronic concentration camp. I've talked to a longtime NSA agent, and they tell me, people always tell me, I'm going to move to, let's say, Bolivia and go off the grid. What I'm told by NSA agents, if you use a toaster, any electronic device, you can be pinpointed. And with drones, by the way, the drones that they have, hummingbird drones now, prototypes, they have seagull drones. They're so small, they have a beetle drone. They're working on a mosquito drone, supposedly.
Yep.
They actually land on you and inject you with something. whatever that is. Or take DNA samples, which is another problem in this country, and blood samples. They're forcibly doing that now. They're taking blood samples from some people and doing rectal exams, by the way. And I've written on that. People can go to the website, ruffit.org, and read about that. But, as far as I'm concerned, it's either we put the brakes on it really, really soon, it's going to spread globally. I mean, the NASA Security Agency is a powerful organization. Everything electronic now is downloaded in a file. So everybody has a file, including me and you.
The U.S. Cyber Command, they have massive storage capabilities up with the NSA facility up in Bluffdale, I believe it was.
Utah,
yeah.
And they coordinate, by the way, with the CIA, the FBI, all the other groups. The FBI has a huge data file.
Now, John, let me ask you quickly there. I heard for a little bit that there was alleged infighting between the NSA and the CIA because they had a little bit of a turf war kind of thing of who would actually oversee the cyber surveillance. What do you know about that? And is that just theatrics, or are they actually in full compliance with each other?
I have no idea whether that's theatrics or not, but I do know they share information, sure, because I'm involved in the cases. We had a case of a young Marine last year did some Facebook posts where he criticized President Obama, which in America is your right to free speech. Last August 2012, he heard a noise outside. He works at home. He'd just gotten through jogging. He didn't have his shirt on. He looks out the window, and eight or nine vehicles have driven up in front of the street in his driveway, and out jumps these people running toward his home in black outfits and some in street clothes, civilian clothes. He steps out and says, "What's up?" And they go, "We've been reading your Facebook posts. We're concerned about what you're saying." They asked him to step out. They handcuffed him. He's a former Marine, Iraq, Afghanistan. He asked for his shirt. They shoved him into a fence, lacerating his back. They took him to the police station. His mother called me. I called the police and said, "What's he charged with?" The cop actually said to me, "He's committed no crime. We're concerned about what he's saying, and he's going to go before a civil commitment board to be evaluated and put in the mental hospital." Oof. He had a two-minute exam in a jail cell with a psychiatrist who deemed him insane. He was eventually put in the Miller Hospital. We got him out in a week. We sued the federal government over it.
Wow.
That was the local police with the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and other federal agencies doing sort of a SWAT raid on him. But that was for Facebook.
What happened to the case? Did you guys win when you sued the government?
I was still in battle in court over it.
Okay. You know, what I've noticed, John, is that it seems to me at this stage, and this is, of course, going to expand and change later on, but it seems to me at this stage that people who have a history in military, they're insiders, if you will. They're working with the government, they're police or military personnel, and they speak out or in some way are critical. Those are the ones that seem to suffer the hardest at this point, right? I mean, even Bradley Manning, for example, right?
Edward Snowden left the country for a reason.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't blame him. He should have left the country if he didn't want to end up like Bradley Manning. In fact, I'll give you a good story. I talked to a national security agent once, not too long ago, about 6 months ago. I was eating dinner, and he walked up and talked to me. He'd been reading my book, A Government of Wolves. And I said, he said, I don't like what the NSA is doing. I'm one of the employees that really disagreed. I said, why don't you come out and expose it? He looked at me and said two words, Bradley Manning, and walked away.
Mm, yep.
So they're afraid. But again, I go back. If the government's doing something wrong, in any government, it's our duty as human beings to expose it. And we're afraid because of what they might do. Put it, you know, Bradley Manning was treated awful, horrifically bad. Put in a lotus position, isolated by himself. For what, doing what reason? Exposing criminal activity by the government.
They use these people as an example to the rest of us, obviously, who have an interest in speaking out. But tell us a little bit more about the psychology of compliance. How you see this formed and tie in maybe education in this as well, because it seems at this stage that it's just as you said, either it's an educational that comes through the entertainment media, and to a certain extent when we have the movies that we have and the TV shows, and they show this same kind of behavior. It's almost like people are getting accustomed to it first through TV, if you will, but at the same time, when it actually happens to them, it's still a shock, because they end up saying it was just like on TV or in the movies kind of thing. But what is the psychology of the compliance, and is this a long kind of long-term plan that is ongoing here?
Well, you know, it's there's something innate in human beings. Human beings have an innate violence, and this is what psychologists say, and I detail it in my book, a tendency toward violence. I mean, it can be curbed through education, sometimes through religion, whatever, and again, that's the way to deal with it. Unfortunately, we don't deal with it very well, but experiments show, you know, there's the famous Stanley Milgram experiments.
Yes.
I detail in the book. He showed very quickly that people can become very, very violent, even in a so-called play situation. Like I said, placing a gun in somebody's hand, there's a tendency to clench it and want to pull the trigger. And then group behavior, by the way, when people get in groups, they tend not to question authority, and it's sort of a gang mentality, or what somebody calls a thug mentality. So I detail that in the book, but this has all been shown by psychological study. The thing that I'm seeing happening in the schools that I think is dangerous is, through the, what we call zero tolerance policies in this country, is punishing kids for, we had to get, I don't know if you, there's a mouthwash here called Scope. We had a case where a kid gargled Scope after lunch, a fourth grader. He was removed from school for violating a zero tolerance policy against drugs, which I didn't know it, but Scope has some alcohol in it. He wasn't drinking alcohol, he was just gargling.
Right.
In this country, in 20 states, children have been thrown out of school or removed from school for at least a day for having Alka-Seltzer against the drug policy. Kids in this country point their finger at somebody and go bang, bang. We had a case like that. They're removed from school, and the police are called in. They're teaching the kids in the school to be very, very compliant against authority.
Yeah.
And again, you can't really get out there and exercise your rights if you're afraid you're going to get banged over the head for the slightest mistake.
Yeah, it's very discouraging. Again, I have to go back to those kinds of points there. But actually, before we do that, let's talk about the Second Amendment a little bit as well, and what you see in terms of weapons and people, you know, wanting to have weapons for obvious reasons of being able to protect both themselves, but also their families and their friends, you know, in cases where this happens, when the government is increasingly, I mean, there's a reason why the governments in Europe has worked so incessantly and so hard to take all the weapons from the people. I think pretty much Switzerland is the only country anymore that really has a kind of policy on it where every male citizen is educated and they actually have a automatic rifle, I think, in their home provided by the government. And again, that's one of the countries with the least amount of crime in the world, actually. But there's been an incessant fight in the media of kind of taking the weapons from the American people. What do you think about that?
Yeah, there's a gun phobia in America, obviously. why there's a Second Amendment provision. It allows Americans to own a weapon and have it in their possession individually in their home. Probably the best quote I've ever seen on weapon possession came from George Orwell. He said, that rifle over the fireplace of the working person is the symbol of freedom. And this is what he meant by it, and why we have a Second Amendment. It balances what the government has. In other words, if only the police and government have weapons, then there's actually no form of resistance. It's like I say, you know, Hitler took the guns away as well. Study history, I tell people. There's a reason. When those trains were on their way to Auschwitz, and it may happen again, how do you resist that? With a pencil? With a frying pan?
Yeah.
No. With a weapon. The people can gather together, become a militia, and defend themselves, like our Second Amendment. So what the Second Amendment does, it balances power. Police kill more people in this country every year, unarmed citizens, than Americans do shooting each other or shooting police. So it's a balance. And Orwell's right. It's a symbol of freedom. That's why we have it in the Second Amendment. If you take the guns away, like in countries, then you're at the behest of a police state. You cannot resist that. The only thing you can do is run or hide or move out of the country. But it's moving worldwide, as you said. Where are you going to go anymore? If you want to go get a weapon or whatever, and I'm not a big pro-gun guy, by the way. I wish guns had never come into being, but they do exist, and the government has a lot of them.
Yes.
Not guns, but every kind of super weapon, from grenade launchers down the line, now lasers and all kinds of stuff on drones. How do you resist that? I'm coming to the point where it's very, very difficult to resist it. When these SWAT team raids, by the way, I have people who call me and say, well, I've got my rifle, I'm ready and waiting on them. You know what I tell them?
No.
Drop that gun and lay it down on the floor. You're going to get killed. You don't have the firepower to resist it.
Well, I've said that too, John, and I don't mean that in a defeatist kind of way, but we're talking about an organization here that have ultimately nuclear weapons at their disposal, you know, and they will use it if necessary. There's an immense power behind that, with the technology, as to say, the developments, then the money. It almost like where the work should be done is in terms of, as I heard you argue already a little bit, education. The people who are part of this apparatus, the government, you know, the police force, who are actively engaged in this militarization, who are not only behind the agenda but also the foot soldiers, if you will, they have to be questioned and, if you will, educated, right?
If you can, but if you question a policeman in this country today, and I tell people, if you're arrested, I mean, if you're driving in this country at night, and they pull you over for speeding, I tell people, shut up, answer his questions, be nice, and move on. Because they're tasering people.
Sure.
I have a case of Malika Brooks in my book. I talk about her. She was a pregnant woman. She argued with some policemen over a speeding ticket. She was 5 months pregnant. They tased her unconsciously and left her laying on the ground. So, what do you do? They have these so-called non-lethal weapons, which, by the way, you know, Amnesty International has come out against tasers as a form of torture. And I agree the way they're used.
Well, they've killed people too, John. Cases.
A lot of people have been killed with tasers, but they're tasering the 71-year-old lady.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a case where an old lady in this country disagreed with the removal of a structure she had in her front yard, was arguing. The police arrived and tasered her to the ground. She's 71 years old. Now, did she resist? No. So why taser them?
Yeah.
So there's that. I go back to the mentality. When they look at us now, they look at us differently. And some people say, I'm afraid of the police. I look back and say, you have a reason to be. But, again, I go back to what I said. In a free country, should you be afraid of the police?
No.
Then you have to question what kind of country you live in.
Well, it's not a free country. That's the case, you know. And of course, when I say question as well, I definitely concur. I don't mean that that's something you should take on the spot there with a police officer or something like that. But I mean, the family members of the officer, the friends of the policeman, who's, you know, who can see that this changes occurring. There has to be a debate internally among friends and families where this behavior and this development is beginning to be questioned, right?
I don't know. I know there are really good policemen that I've had meetings with. They question it. I'm not sure I think they're in the minority, the extreme minority, and I don't want to speak because I've not met, you know, all the policemen. But I have some that are very, very nervous about what's going on. They've read my book. They pass it out saying we got to slow this thing down because they're afraid we're going to lose this country. And they're absolutely correct. But I don't know how much they debate. What I hear from people in the police academies, this is what they're teaching now. And there's not a lot of debate going on.
Yeah. Now, let's take a break here in a little bit, and then we're going to carry on. I want to ask you more about the media participation in this as well. I want to ask you, you wrote a good piece on John Carpenter, some of his movies. A lot of the dystopian ideas out there that have been floating around about the police states is something that you've also brought in and incorporated into your work. And then we can talk more about where the technology is going, the development of DARPA, and you know, you were into drones there a little bit, but there's more things beyond that as well. But before we take a break, John, let's just talk a little bit about your websites, where people can go to read more about you, about your work, follow your articles, and of course also where they can pick up a copy of your latest book, A Government of Wolves. So please go ahead and give us the details.
Yeah, I write a weekly commentary on Rutherford.org, O-R-G. People can go, and they should read it, because again, I'm a footnoter. Everything I say is footnoted. And then my book's available on Amazon.com. It has 30 pages of footnotes. So I'm not a conspiratorialist at all. I look at the facts and report what's going on.
All right, very good. Rutherford.org and also agovernmentofwolves.com. That's the website for the book. All right, well, we'll take a short break here. John, stay with us, and we'll be right back with more after this break.
Where does the good times go? Where does the river flow? Does the good times go? Lips that used to burn with love now are cold beneath my touch. Still I love you oh so much. Where does the good times go? Where does the good times go? Where does the river flow? Where does the north wind blow? Where does the good times go? Arms that used to hold me tight, eyes that shone with love so bright, now have changed like day to night. Where does the good times go? Where does the good times go? Where does the river flow? Where does the north wind blow? Where does the good times go? Where does the good times go?
Please join us in our second hour at redicemembers.com as we continue to talk about the advancing police state, not only in America, but around the globe with John Whitehead. We discussed the media's involvement and the technology development by DARPA and Boston Dynamics to create a global electronic concentration camp. We also talk about John Carpenter's films as being highly critical of these developments. John also points the finger to the emerging friendly fascism all around us. The third way, a tyranny with a velvet glove, and this is the servitude that we'll all learn to love, right in accordance with what Huxley wrote about many years ago. We later discuss home education, NSA, the secret government, and the lack of literary knowledge. Join us at redicemembers.com. Sign up for a membership and continue to listen to this or any of our previous programs And of course, check out all the other material that we have there for you as well. We have upcoming on Red Ice Radio, Randall Carlson, Anthony Peake, Richard Dewhurst, and many, many more. For now, we say thank you for listening. We'll talk to you on the other side of this break.